It seemed to Frodo then that he heard quite plainly but far off voices out of the past.
What a pity Bilbo did not stab the vile creature when he had a chance.
Pity? It was pity that stayed his hand. Pity and mercy, not to strike without need.
I do not feel any pity for Gollum. He deserves death.
Deserves death? I dare say he does. Many that live deserve death, and some die that deserve life. Can you give that to them? Then be not too eager to deal out death in the name of justice, fearing for your own safety. Even the wise cannot see all ends.
Welcome to a sacred fellowship where we are reading the works of J.R.R. Tolkien, using sacred practices. We are using these texts to learn to reflect on our lives and to think about life's big questions. We believe that by treating classics like Lord of the Rings as sacred, we will learn to treat one another as sacred.
This is episode 57, where your hosts, Catherine Olson and myself, Lorianne Schwenk, will be discussing the first chapter in The Journey of the Ring Bearers, The Taming of Sméagol. Am I saying that right? Sméagol?
Yeah.
Sméagol? Thank you.
Well, it has articulation on the accent, so.
So I'm saying Sméagol at me if you've got a problem with it. And we're reading this chapter through the theme of will. Take a seat on the edge of that cliff overlooking the marshes or in your car and join us. Reading in community is an essential part of what it means for us to treat a text as sacred, and we are glad you're here to continue building community with us. So, hi, Catherine.
Hello there.
Do you have a dungeon or a tower for us this week?
Well, the tower is that tomorrow my siblings and nephews and nieces start pouring into town from various places to have the family reunion that we haven't had in a few years. And the dungeon is that I have had the same just headache coming and going for the last 9 days. And so I haven't felt like I've gotten a good night's sleep. In all that time, and I'm really not up to feeling ready to be cheerful for that event, so I'm trying to get some kind of energy before Wednesday when I start being expected to enjoy myself. And I know I will enjoy myself, but I'm like, no one deserves my bad mood, and I feel like I'm in a bad mood right now.
I'm sorry. Well, one of my dungeons is I feel like I've added to that by being late to our recording session, so I'm going to apologize publicly.
Well, some things are worth waiting for. So.
Well, thanks. My main dungeon is I've got somebody I haven't heard from for a while, so I'm starting to be a little worried about that. And my tower is what was it again? Anyway, my tower is, well, I got to do that interview for that oral history project today, and that was a real hoot. So if anybody hasn't done that and would like information on that, please let us know on our Facebook page, A Sacred Fellowship. Catherine had made an announcement about it with the link, and it's really, really fun, and it's wonderful. So it's really a delightful thing to do. So I got to do that earlier today. So that's my tower for today.
And best of all, it takes all of about 5 minutes to go from setup to sign off.
Right, right. So it's really nice and it's important. And he'd like to have 6,000 people. So there's plenty of space for your story about...
Well, what number are you?
I don't know. I don't know.
Oh, well, no, I'm number 644, so maybe we'll be that. In the same aerodrome.
Right, so. Right. Oh, we will. So, it's exciting. We'll be mustered or whatever he said. So that is exciting. So. And then our story this week is on Will, and that is mine. And I had so many to choose from, and none of them felt entirely right. But I think I'm going to go back in time to college because I think it probably happens to a lot of people, but I think I was very much, there was no there for Lorianne. There was no Lorianne. And that I was basically a dim reflection of other people's projections for a long time. And it happened gradually, maybe starting when I was 16, but definitely within my first year of college, that Lorianne started to show up. And what I mean by that is just really having my own sense of will. Mm-hmm. And I had started with this major in music therapy, and I loved it, and I could have done it. And in some ways it felt safe. I knew there would be work. I knew I wouldn't ever have to be a great concert performer with this major. I could be adequate. And there was something about that adequacy that suddenly woke me up and woke up my will. And my, I don't even necessarily mean willpower, and the Gammers will talk about this a little bit, but my vehemence, my real will to be who I was meant to be. And I changed my major to performance. And so I got my major in violin performance, where there is no safety net. There is no backup. There's nothing safe about that whatsoever. All you have looking forward is work, work, work. But it was worth it for me. And I ended up graduating summa cum laude. I did very well. And so it did teach me to listen to my gut, to listen to my instinct, to listen to the inner voice. And it also, and this is kind of on a bigger topic, I believe also in harmonizing my will with a greater will. And for me, that happens to be God. I am one of those people. But I also feel like I can tell when I'm fighting against that greater will. And so I bring that up again, because I'm not really trying to convince somebody to be something that they don't want to be. But I do feel like there is a way of being in harmony, perhaps with a greater purpose or perhaps with the universe. And I encourage people to listen for that, because, man, things go faster and easier when you're in that harmony. When you're fighting against it, when you're kicking against the goads, things don't work as well. So I'll just throw that out there. And I've already done my exhortation. So there.
I was about to mention that.
Right. So let us move on. Shall we? I know I'm talking a lot already, but shall we hear from the Gammers?
Yes, I bet they have a lot of things. I'm curious, you mentioned in the Facebook group that you were fascinated by the unit of measurement, the L. And I had to look up on Facebook, not Facebook, on Google, exactly how long a fathom was so I could figure out the length of this rope.
And it's interesting because a fathom is usually used in
maritime things.
Yeah, maritime measurements. And so I find that interesting. And then that is 18. So 18 fathoms would be about 108 feet. So a fathom is about 6 feet. And then an L goes all the way back to the Proto-Indo-European root L.
Gosh, what did have thought of that for you?
And it links up to elbow. And so it's either a measurement from the hand to the elbow or the entire length of the arm. It varies from country to country. And then, of course, we know that halibuts are smaller. So it is really hard to figure out. But in Tudor English, it would have been about 45 inches. And in Scotland, it's about 37.2 inches. And then the Flemish measurement is about 27 inches for an L. So it's hard to know. But we do know that there was more than enough rope for the use, even when it was tied around something. So whatever measurement of L we're using, it was more than 18 fathoms. So, So we'll get to that. Will, I'll just go back to that. Willin, to wish, to desire, to be used to be about to. You know, we say I will or I shall. And the difference there, I shall means necessity or obligation. I will means intention or my own volition. And so there's that vol word, vol or vela from Latin, wish, will, desire. And that's why I was talking about, I desired to change my major. It wasn't just the willpower, I'm gonna do this and show all those people. It was, I desire to really focus on my playing. And that's where that came from. And So the Sanskrit root means to choose or to prefer, vrnoti, V-R-N-O-T-I. The Greek is E-L-P-I-S-L-P-I-S. And then the Latin becomes volo or vella, which then becomes will. And what other way? We have pallid in this chapter. And then I got to learn about doublets, because I mean, it seems like it's more than just a synonym, but pallid means the same thing as pale. So mm-hmm. doublet would be just one of those instances where you've got another word. Maybe it's like use and utilize. There's literally no reason for the word utilize to exist. Try it, everybody. Every sentence you want to use utilize, just use. I mean it. So pallid goes all the way back to the P-I-E there, the Proto-Indo-European P-E-L. So I find that fascinating that pale has always meant pale. Just fascinating. With bite, which is a P-I-E word there. I'm just not even going to say it anymore. P-I-E,
yep.
Big. I have no idea how to pronounce that. B-H-E-U-G, which means to bend. The old English would be bite, B-Y-H-T, bend, angle, corner. And so that tells us how long this rope was, because Frodo mentions there was quite a bite at the bottom. After Sam had dropped the rope down from the top of the cliff. Turn and turn about, it was an interesting phrase in this. And so it means one after another. I kind of didn't know, I didn't get that at first, but it means one of them will stay awake while the other allows himself to sleep. We'll see how well that works. We have fathom, of course, we've talked about. Rampart, again, is a seawall. So again, another maritime word is being used to describe this landscape. And Latin would have come from ante parare, so before prepare. So a rampart is this kind of preparation before you need it, this architectural structure that you use to prepare yourself to protect yourself. And the T gets added on at the end when it gets to French. And then two more things, or three, sorry. Two being the number, no, three. Doom, I just
five.
Right. Doom would be going back to the Council of Elrond, the doom we must deem, mm-hmm. I think was the line. It's a reminder that doom is not just a negative. It means a judgment, a decision, a justice that's been administered. It originally was a neutral term and did not have the negative feeling to that. So it's just a decision. So when Frodo is talking about his doom, he is not necessarily meaning that in a negative way. Also, grudge, which is an old word for complaining. And so I thought that was fascinating, because I think of grudging meaning unwillingly, not willing. And it does in a way, but it also means with complaint. And that struck a memory for me. My family is Pennsylvania Dutch. And I know about six words from that, but one of them was grexing. And so my grandparents, if I was too whiny, would say, stop grexing. And here we go, grudging, grexing. There's a mm-hmm. little tie for this Germanic root, grudge, there. And I think that is it. And then my last thing, and I'm going to, we're shorter on time than we normally are. So I'm going to put this in our Facebook page, or maybe make a second breakfast. But I noticed the phrasing great gray. And I reminded me of the great green dragon.
Yes.
And so I will talk on our Facebook page about word order with an adjective. There is an order 10 being the number of adjectives before you can get to a noun. And there is a specific order in English. Tolkien uses great gray 10 times in Lord of the Rings. So I know this was in his mind all his life. So I will talk about word order at another time. But the Gammers had a lot for this chapter. There's much less for next chapter. So thank you for letting them go on and on just a wee bit. And now we're going to talk about Will. And did you want to start with a character or just go through the chapter? How did you?
Well, I thought at first that you were going to be going through the characters, and then I saw that you included things like the rope and the nature or natural elements as
those are characters
in the chapter. So I think we can pick any one of those. So you give me a character to consider, and I will give you my first excerpt for that character.
Let's start with Samwise the Great.
Well, then I'm going to not go with my first instance of that, but with my favorite one, if you'll just give me a minute to pull it up, since I have a wonderful Word document open with everything arranged by characters and in order.
Great. However you want to do it. Tell me your Sam story with Will.
Okay.
What a chapter.
It's a huge chapter in terms of horrible things.
Yeah.
Okay. So this is sorry, I just accidentally pulled it on the wrong page. There we go. Sam knelt beside him, being Frodo, and peered reluctantly over the edge. Then he glanced up at the great cliff rising up away on their left. Easier, he grunted. Well, I suppose it's always easier getting down than up. Those as can't fly can jump. It would be a big jump still, said Frodo. He stood for a moment, measuring it with his eyes. About 18 fathoms, I should guess, not more. And that's enough, said Sam. Ugh, how I do hate looking down from a height. But looking is better than climbing. And it reminds me of, I'm going to give a little bit of a story that might embarrass my mother if she hears this ever.
Which she will.
When I was 19 and a half, my parents decided that we were going to fulfill one of my dad's lifelong dreams to hike to Machu Picchu on the Inca Trail. Mm-hmm. And we were quite fine with the entire thing, where we had to be up in these mountains for days at a time. And then we got to the descent from the final mountain down into the valley where Machu Picchu is. And my mother discovered that she was suddenly afraid of heights. Not specifically, you know, heights in general, but she was looking down at this and just started saying, I can't get down this hill. I cannot face this specific distance. And so I feel like she relates a little bit to Sam, where there is something slightly unknown about what you're going to do if you're going in the climbing down then going up, because you know that one will take an effort, but you don't really know what you will be facing if you are getting down rather than up.
I love it. And it seems like there's a lot of times in this chapter where Sam's will is challenged a bit. I mean, he goes running after Frodo, of course, and his will and intention and volition is to remain by his master's side. But even in the start of the chapter, we're in a fierce and no mistake, his fear of heights. And then when they are realizing that they're going to have Gollum with them, I think that's a real challenge to Sam's will throughout. Mm-hmm. So I have a note for my own, just his hatred of Gollum. And so it's his will to try to stay awake. He does not trust Gollum, so he's really trying to stay awake. And then it's his real will and nature to be gentle when it comes time to, you know, they've got the rope. It's obviously torturing Gollum, and he's gentle taking it off, even if his words are not gentle. So I see he's kind of at war with his willpower in a way.
Well, I think there's a real dichotomy in this chapter, because we have seen for all of his story so far the loyalty that he has to Frodo, but this takes an uncommon amount of trust in Frodo's judgment and Frodo's will itself. And so I think that's one of those places where you can't exactly know that you want to do this, but you want to believe it's possible. And so the struggle between Sam's doubts and Frodo's need for action are a real kind of force in this entire tale.
Right. And well, that's a good intro to Frodo and the theme of will. And I found it just heartbreaking, his sentence, "All my choices have proved ill." And if he had any idea who else is saying almost that exact sentence, it's just heartbreaking. And then, of course, that brings in the will of someone greater, not named in the chapter, but God, Iluvatar, Eru. These choices actually end up not proving amiss or ill.
Well, they shall prove but by an instrument.
Amen. And so I see with Frodo saying, "It's my doom, a way will be found," that it's his will to proceed. It isn't his joy, but it is his will to find a way. So I know I moved on to Frodo. Were you ready? Was there more?
Oh, I've got many different quotes from many different people, so we can just like skip around as you direct.
All right. How about another for Frodo then?
Oh, let's see. "Mordor," he muttered under his breath. "If I must go there, I wish I could come there quickly and make an end." He shuddered. The wind was chilly and yet heavy with an odor of cold decay. "Well," he said at last, withdrawing his eyes, "we cannot stay here all night, fix or no fix. We must find a more sheltered spot and camp once more, and perhaps another day will show us a path." "Or another and another and another," muttered Sam. "Or maybe no day, we've come the wrong way." "I wonder," said Frodo, and then he says that part about it. "It's my doom, I think, to go to that shadow yonder so that a way will be found." Then he says, "Delay plays into the enemy's hands, and here I am delayed."
Yes, yes.
And so I have such sympathy for, first of all, Frodo believes that he has made all of these ill choices, but this idea that the enemy's gaining strength, or that he's having power given to him by delays, and that so everything he has done so far, not just in his choices, but in his own weaknesses and in his real ineptitude, and that just, you know, it's not his fault that he grew up in the Shire, and as much as he was Bilbo's heir, he did not grow up to be wandering around the Emmon Mule. And so he just feels constantly culpable for delaying the weakening of his enemy.
And I hear that, and especially when he wants to get down this cliff and it's night. This would be terrifying for me under any circumstances, but I would especially hate it at night. So I'm in awe of his will here to get down this cliff.
Well, I know I've mentioned before that I'm not sure how many episodes ago, but there are the cognitive distortions that they mark as hallmarks of certain mental illnesses. And Frodo is using one that's a very common one, which is there are a number of them, ones that he's using, but the one that kind of brings to mind is catastrophization, where everything is irreparable, everything is disastrous. And the thing that's really remarkable in this is that because of his will, he combats that so successfully, or we don't know exactly how absent it is by the end of the chapter, this kind of self-loathing, or not self-loathing, self-deprecation, but we know that he has moved past that into taking action against what he feels he is doing to make things worse.
And there's a piece also that is not necessarily in the chapter, but noticed it by its absence. Frodo has the will not to share what Boromir did and said. And I'm assuming that because we don't see it, I think if it were important, we would see that conversation. So if I'm wrong, I'll find out later. But I am guessing that Frodo has kept that secret, and that is great willpower on his part not to confide that, I would say. And I think that's, he does not know that Boromir has died, and he does not know that, he does find out, we know, in this book, but I don't even know. I can't remember yet. I have to get to those chapters again. It's been a couple of months. whether he even shares with Faramir what happened.
That's what I'm trying to look up right now.
I don't think he does. So I think that's a sign of very strong will there to honor this member of the fellowship, even when he had threatened him. And while you're looking, I had thought of something that I didn't bring up, and I know it's not fair, but I wanted to talk really briefly about the will of others in the face of the ring. And so we have seen Gandalf using his will to resist. He never touches it. Same with Aragorn, and he's offered it. I mean, he could have taken it from them, we know, at the Prancing Pony by force if he were going to, and he doesn't. And Frodo offers it at the council, and he refuses. Boromir does not take it from him. And no one else, Galadriel is the other person. So we have seen these people have their will tested and succeed. And now, I mean, the name of this book is The Ring Bearers. Mm-hmm. And so now we're going to have at least two people holding the ring, or who have had a history of holding the ring now together. Oh, we even saw Bilbo, a former holder of the ring, and his temptation and wanting it back. So when talking about the ring and its will, I also just wanted to reflect a little bit on the will of others in the face of it.
So, absolutely. Sorry. You actually left out Gandalf, who is tempted. He's offered it. I only heard Frodo you mentioned Galadriel and Boromir.
Yeah, my first was Gandalf.
Didn't hear that.
You were looking at Faramir. So does he ever talk about what Boromir does?
I am not able to find it in the book. I know that there is a line in the movie then that is out of the context of the book, and it answers that question.
Okay, well,
from Frodo.
we're not in the movie. So,
yeah.
And the movies are pale reflections of these books. Anything more on Will with Frodo?
Let me get back to it. Sorry, I went to a completely different chapter.
I'm sorry.
So this is where it is marvelous to have a Kindle edition, so I can just go, okay, where did I find that one thing?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think for me, it's just his will to move on. And that comes up several times in the chapter. So,
well, I do have a question, actually, while I'm getting back to that, that has to do with what you were just talking about with the will of others in the face of the ring. Do you think that the people who are responding to the ring are responding to the ring itself or to the ring bearer?
Oh my goodness. I think it's the ring because I think offhand it's the ring because they see what they would do with the ring. Boromir sees how it could be helpful for him against the enemy. Gandalf sees how he would be terribly great or greatly terrible. Galadriel would go all nuclear. and even later, Sam has his fantasies about Samwise the Great and all of that. Mm-hmm. So I think it's the ring, personally.
I think there's an element of truth to that. I'm just remembering that it is says somewhere in the beginning of the Fellowship of the Ring, I believe it's a Gandalf remark that it, you know, the ring increases a person's power according to their stature. Mm-hmm. And so I feel like they're at some point in untold histories of Middle Earth somewhere, or if anyone know it would be our friends who have wandered over from the Prancing Pony podcast, but they would say that there are instances of people responding to those who have wielded the power of the ring, and I'm curious about it, whether or not there are other stories that are kind of depictions of that.
I'll have to look into that. That's a good one. Don't let me forget that. Mm-hmm. Shall we move on to another ring bearer then in Gollum?
Sorry, I never actually got back to that question you asked about Frodo.
Frodo.
Sorry, I found that I had already answered that one quote that I was going to look beyond the river.
There's so many senses and all of that in this landscape that are in the text. It's amazing. Just an amazing piece of text. Rivers and marshes and stones. And
This is towards the beginning of the chapter. It's talking about how the hobbits have been standing at the brink of a tall cliff, and they were looking towards the east and seeing these shapeless lands before them, and the sickly green of them was fading to a sullen brown. And then it says, but their eyes did not look beyond the river, back to Gondor, to their friends, to the lands of men. South and east they stared to where, at the edge of the oncoming night, a dark line hung like distant mountains of motionless smoke. And I feel like that is such a wonderful example of, for both of the hobbits, of their will being to, it's almost a Sodom and Gomorrah moment where they are looking towards the future rather than looking to what they have left behind. And so that focus is really admirable.
Yes. Yes. I admire that. No doubt. No looking back. Yes. And so shall we turn to Gollum and his will?
Oh, poor, poor Gollum or Sméagol. So where's an example for you?
Well, let's see. I know our pages are different, so that's not going to help. What is that? He has, when Frodo tells Gollum that Gollum has no will over Sauron. So he has gone into this terrible fit, as it were, not for you, we won't, not for you, he collapsed, don't look at us, go away, go to sleep. So here's an instance where Gollum does not have the will to affect the thing he most wants, to have Sauron to stop seeking him or torturing him somehow. And then later for me, it looks as though there is this battle between the wills of Sméagol and Gollum, and Sméagol is starting to have the upper hand. And so Sméagol's will is starting to take some prominence. And I find that fascinating.
Well, not to digress again and again and again, or another day and another day and another day, as Sam would say. But I took a class a number of years ago on writing various aspects of mental illness, because that's one of the things that fascinates me as a writer. And he was the professor who was actually someone who worked extensively in the Department of Corrections in Utah, had given this class based on his experiences with various people in the correctional institutions. And he described a man who had been to Vietnam, had served in that war. And then one day he was home, it was 20 years since Vietnam, and he was hijacked carjacked rather, and in order to give himself the strength to fight back against the people who were attacking him, he imagined, or he dissociated to this state where he saw them as Viet Cong soldiers, and he was actually eventually arrested and convicted for having killed those people. But this was how he described it. And so I see these two parts of Sméagol and Gollum, or Slinker and Stinker, so they call him later quite unkindly. But he talks a lot about the torments and tortures that he suffered in Mordor by accident, or he remembers the cruelty of other people or other elves, hobbits, etc. And so I feel like he has a dissociation in himself. I mean, this is very clear both in the book and other sources, but I feel like the dissociation into Gollum is one where he sees Sméagol as the one who was vulnerable and the one who fell prey, and Gollum is the one who took the power that he derived from having gone through that, and who will not relinquish a chance to have power. And so he is definitely the more insidious version of this.
Right. I'd be curious, whose will is involved here? So we have very close to the end, a page and a half or so. Sméagol, said Gollum suddenly and clearly, Sméagol will swear on the precious. So I'm curious, is this the will of the ring exerting itself, or the will of Sméagol over Gollum? Hold that thought. Frodo, this is so fascinating. Himself up, and again, Sam was startled by his words and his stern voice. On the precious? How dare you, he said. Think. one ring to rule them all and in the darkness bind them. So is that Frodo mastering the ring or joining Sméagol in being under the will of the ring or using the ring to manage Sméagol? What do you think?
Oh, I have this saved. I'm hoping this will come out right because it's like a very clear answer to that in my head. And sometimes they don't get from my head to my voice very well. But we know that the ring is giving him power and giving him temptation to exert power. It talks about how Sauron imbued the ring with the will to dominate others. Mm-hmm. And Frodo, I think, in this, with the sternness and with the stature that Sam observes, is using the power that the ring gives him. But because of his good heart, it is used not as an act of dominance, but an act mm-hmm. of restraint of some kind. And it's a benevolent restraint. It is a protective measure. It's almost a custodial thing mm-hmm. where he is doing this only so Gollum cannot do further harm to himself.
And I think it's fascinating then they could reach one another's minds.
Mm-hmm.
And so they are linked here in this sort of, is it a trinity of Sméagol, Gollum, Frodo, or is it actually a foursome of Sméagol, Gollum, Frodo, ring? It's fascinating. So, I am curious about the storm that happens, whether you think that is the will of just the weather, or if that is the will of Mordor.
Oh, which one? Because we have a number of places where so the reason why I say which one is because we have this depiction of the darkness to the east, and we know from another Gandalf quote that Sauron sends basically a fume or a cloud cover to speed his armies on his way. And so that is one possible source of the darkness to the east, but mm-hmm. also there is definitely an influence of the weather in aiding the flight of the Nazgul that they see later. And so I think that is a little bit of a combination of both.
Mm-hmm.
It's definitely the weather is not all weather is caused by the will of Sauron, but not all the will of Sauron is absence from the weather, mm-hmm. absent from the weather. Feels like a rectangle square comparison.
Right. No, it feels like that's right. And we know that storm has an impact on the battle at Helm's Deep, correct? Is that mm-hmm. right? Yeah, I think it's the same storm. I'm trying to follow the scheme here.
I know.
It's hard.
We need a weather map for this chapter.
Weather map and a calendar and everything. So I am then curious about the will of the rope. And mm-hmm. I am very curious how that got untied, because part of me thinks Gollum did it. And I know
it's so hard to tell.
Right. I know it burns him when they put it on him, but he's after them. He's pursuing them. He's not that far behind. And how else does a rope get untied that has just borne the weight of two individuals climbing down the hill with their belongings and everything?
Well, I mean, there's so much we see that the Gollum feels the burning of the rope around him when it's really binding him or exerting force mm-hmm. over him. So it's possible that when he is on the other end of the power spectrum, he's able to do it less painfully, or it's just possible that he takes the risk of suffering pain in order to do damage to someone else. Mm. On the other hand, I could completely see the argument for the idea that Hithline rope wound by the elves is the kind that has a kind of symbiotic relationship with the person using it, so that when Frodo needs the rope to come to him, it willingly goes with him, because that's just the sort of thing Tolkien would put in his books.
So I see it as the will of the rope, and you are probably right. And there's just that little voice in the back of my head that's going to keep asking that question until somebody finally convinces me otherwise. So, but I've been dying to ask you that question. Oh my mm-hmm. goodness.
It's a great question.
Was there anything else you had for Will in this chapter, or are you ready to move on to our sacred practice?
Mm. Sorry, let me get to one section.
I will.
Because there is a Gollum quote that we have not addressed that I absolutely kind of want to discuss in the context of the Will of the Ring.
Okay.
So, Gollum collapsed and went as loose as wet string. Mm-hmm. Sam caught up, fingering his shoulder. His eyes smoldered with anger, but he could not avenge himself. His miserable enemy lay groveling on the stones, whimpering. Mm-hmm. Don't hurt us. Don't let them hurt us, precious. They won't hurt us until, will they, nice little hobbitses? Mm-hmm. We didn't mean no harm, but they jumps on us like cats on poor mice as they did, precious. And we're so lonely, Gollum. We will be nice to them, very nice, if they'll be nice to us. Won't we? Yes, yes. And then he says, Sam suggests that they tie him up and leave him behind, and Dave Gollum responds, but that would kill us, cruel little hobbits, as they tie us up in the cold hard lands and leaves us, Gollum, Gollum. Mm-hmm. But I have this, it's hard sometimes with Gollum's pronouns. I don't like to use the aversion to pronouns in Pride Month, but when he talks about us and they and things, it's really hard sometimes to determine who exactly is behind those pronouns. And so with, they won't, don't let them hurt us. They won't hurt us, will they? And so I feel like the they is definitely Frodo and Sam. He's giving himself almost a reassurance that he is in hands of people who are averse to doing him harm. But on the other hand, it says, don't let them hurt us, precious. He is invoking the power of the ring. And I'm curious if he is being misled by the ring to think that if he is able to reclaim it, there will be some kind of relief for him.
Is it capitalized or not, precious? There.
It is not.
Then I think he's referring to himself. I think when it's capitalized, Tolkien and Smeag Gollum means the ring. So he also calls himself precious, and he has often done that. So I think in that case, he's referring to himself. But yes, don't let them hurt us. Does he even mean ring wraiths or orcs at this point? But yes. And then just my final note would be on Frodo's pity, because we have that call back to Gandalf. And so that pity is starting to flourish in him. And so his will is then not to hurt Gollum. And so that is going to play a role over these next few chapters, I know. And so I see that Gandalf saying all those things way back in the Shire are affecting Frodo's will. So,
and you are correct. When he's talking about the ring specifically, where he's swearing to swear on the precious, he says on the capital precious, the capital precious.
Yes, yes, right. All right, are we ready to move into our sacred practice?
I think it's a good time for that.
We are moving back to Pardes, which is a Jewish form of sacred reading. Mm-hmm. And the letters are, it's called an acronym, is that right?
Yes.
Yes, it's an acronym formed from the initial consonants. So the P of Pardes is just the straight, literal, direct meaning. The Remez, the R, is hints or allegoric, hidden or symbolic meanings. Drash is to inquire, comparative, looking for similar occurrences. And then Sod is a secret that might be revealed to us in the reading. And you were going to pick a passage for us.
Yes, for me it is under hard clear stars they set off.
Under hard clear stars they set off. So for the Peshat, or the literal direct meaning, do you want to read some of the surrounding passage and then tell us what's going on?
Yes, just a second.
It's the last paragraph, I think.
Yes, I just have to get back to the chapter since I was looking something else up for one of the other elements of it.
Okay.
Okay, he took a few steps away and looked back inquiring like a dog inviting them for a walk, this being Gollum. Wait a bit, Gollum, cried Sam. Not too far ahead now. I'm going to be at your tail and I've got the rope handy. No, no, said Gollum. Smeagol promised. In the deep of the night, under hard clear stars, they set off. Gollum led them back northward for a while along the way they had come.
All right.
So they have finally secured his promise of allegiance, mm-hmm. if not alliance, and they are ready to go forward with him as their companion.
Right. And he has said he knows the way and he will help them. So, yes. All right. So Remes, hints or allegoric meaning beyond the literal sense. Is there anything that comes up for you in under hard, clear stars they set off?
There are two different places, specifically in the Lord of the Rings, that it reminds me of. First of all, the meeting with Gildor in the first book when Frodo is on his way to the village of Bree, and it says that a star shines upon our meeting.
Mm-hmm.
And so the idea that they are doing things under a hard, clear stars implies that it's under the same power that gives the elves their powers, for lack of a better word, because, you know, there are only so many ways to say it. But right. Also in the Mirror, after they have left Moria, there's a place where Gimli describes that after reaching this place, he looks into the Mirror and sees the mountains crowned with stars. And so it's another place of commencement, another place in which an undertaking is done under the watchful eyes of these stars.
So that's more the Drash step, and that's fine. And so I was thinking about that as well, and I didn't look anything up particular, but I was thinking of Arendil as being the evening star. I was thinking about just the importance of stars all through, that there's many instances. I don't know all of them as well as someone who's read things well, so feel free to give me.
Well, there is specifically Varda the Starkling Kindler that we keep on seeing invoked throughout these books, especially in Frodo's presence.
Okay, interesting. So for me, an allegoric meaning or a hint there, the Remes, might be that while there's not that much light, there is the starlight, which is still a bit protecting. And so the landscape may be desolate and destroyed and not life-giving, but I'm seeing something life-giving and hopeful in the fact that they're under hard, clear stars, that they cannot be tainted by Sauron and his evil. So
then that actually reminds me of the escape from the Barrow Downs, where they are looking for sunshine and instead find a cool, clear light. And so this is the same kind of unlooked for, but still valid form of illumination in a place of darkness.
Nice. I like that. And I think I'd have to look back, but when Bilbo comes out of the Battle of the Five Armies, when he regains consciousness and all that, isn't it night? I think there's some reference there to stars as well. I'd have to go back and look, but mm-hmm. I'm just remembering that it's night, and so it would have been even harder to find him since he has the ring on. But he does. So now I'm going to read it one more time, and this time we'll look for our secret, our sode, some mystery in this. So that would be something personal for us. Under hard, clear stars, they set off. So anything come through for you there?
Oddly enough, it comes back to what you were talking about in your story with finding a motivation or finding a will to make a change or try something new. And it calls to me that under any circumstances, even when things seem uncertain and dark, there is a possibility of a new path in life.
I like that. Yes. And I think for me, the secret is that, yes, even in those times when you don't see the way, when I don't see the way, there is still something. And also something about the constancy of stars. I mean, it takes a long time for them to move. So for us, I mean, We've seen the Big Dipper all our lives. We'll see the Big Dipper for the rest of our lives. Someday it won't look like that, but not in the span of a human life. So I think for me, I can talk about them as a constancy. And so it's an anchor in a way. So to remember that there are things that anchor for us, even when change is all around.
Oh, you're making it very hard not to quote Les Miserables.
Oh, don't. Okay, so next week we will be discussing chapter 2 of The Journey of the Ring Bearers, which is...
The Passage of the Marshes.
Passage of the Marshes through the theme of perception. We will continue this practice of Pardes. And do you have any exhortation for characters? I already said mine.
Yes, you did. My exhortation is for Gollum to spend less time thinking of what pain he might suffer and looking for instead for what freedom he might find.
Oh, I love that. That's wonderful. And we love hearing from all of you, and our community is growing stronger every day. And if you'd like to join our Facebook community, it is called A Sacred Fellowship. Please answer the 2 very easy questions and we'll let you in. On Twitter, we are A Sacred Fellows and then the number 1. And Instagram is A Sacred Fellowship. And you can send an email to asacredfellowship@gmail.com. Thank you to all of you for keeping our spirits up and our thoughts flowing. Please read and comment on Second Breakfast at our website, www.asacredfellowship.com.
I'm hoping that there will be a few more Second Breakfasts coming up since our larders are looking a little bit sparse.
Yes, they will.
But we also value the contributions of our Patreon supporters. Your support of this site and hosting costs is much appreciated, especially as we're just renewing some things this week, in fact. Mm-hmm. And if you feel inspired to join their ranks, please look at our options on www.patreon.com/asacredfellowship. Perks have ranged out from patron shoutouts to Tolkien-themed presents, and we appreciate every dollar.
We're a simple little podcast, but it does take some infrastructure and anything you can help to do that. And if we get more than that, we'll get better. Mm-hmm. Right. Do you have a note from the Shire?
I do. I was asking in the community question what an example is for people of ways that will have made their lives better or helped, and ways in which it has harmed them. Mm-hmm. And we have a comment from Susan who said that she was helped by adopting a healthier lifestyle, including mental health, food, exercise, and leaving the now ex-husband. And of course, her harmed is also a reference to that. She said that she stayed in an abusive relationship. I do want to just kind of shout out this one because if anyone has not read yet Jane Monkton Smith's article on the BBC about the stages of abuse and the violence escalation that it goes through, it is groundbreaking work, and it's something that we should all be better aware of. And I've really been edified by understanding it better this last week. But as someone who herself left an abusive relationship, I appreciate Susan having the strength to do so.
Yes, yay, Susan. I love Susan. She's one of my sisters I haven't met yet. Right. So we welcome all your thoughts on vigilance, both in the chapter and in your own stories. And I think that brings us to the end of this story. Let the stories always continue.
Yes, and thank you as always for spending this time with us. May Elbereth protect you. Be of good hope. Namarie.
Namarie.